playing field, and that we had gotten to the point where U.S. corporations were paying among the highest taxes in the world. And so if you're going to be globalist, you have to reset them.
This is USA Radio News.
Filling an opening at your company means more than just finding an employee. You're looking for a fit, a match. Robert Half understands that. We know you need someone who can do the work, someone who complements your culture. And, of course, you need that someone fast. When it all comes together, it makes for a perfect fit. Satisfaction guaranteed. Robert Half, the matching experts in accounting, finance, IT, legal, marketing, and administrative staffing. Visit roberthalf.com/radio for more information.
United Airlines is reviewing its policies concerning transporting pets after two recent incidents. Meanwhile, the ASPCA has some advice for people flying with pets. And USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has the details.
Following a couple of incidents involving United Airlines, one where a puppy died and a second where a dog was mistakenly sent to Japan instead of Kansas, the ASPCA says you should always get a pet microchipped. Also, purchase a shipping crate that's the correct size and mark the crate with the words live animal. The organization also says travelers traveling with a pet should try to book a direct flight whenever possible.
This year, your taxes have to be filed by April 17th. It's moved back because of a holiday in the District of Columbia. What if you actually owe the IRS money and owe taxes? Well, Dave Ramsey, he's the CEO of Ramsey Solutions Incorporated. He says you want to get things squared away with the IRS ASAP.
You do not want to put anyone ahead of the KGB, I mean the IRS. They have unlimited power to mess with your life, and they charge a lot of interest and a lot of penalties. So we always put them first.
That audio courtesy of Fox News. Ramsey did also point out that the main thing you need to figure out, though, is why you're having to pay the IRS this year or years prior. And finally, if your bracket has been busted, you are not alone. The odds of getting a perfect bracket, 1 in 128 billion. For USA Radio News, my name is Tim Berg.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnsspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon on this beautiful, sunny Friday afternoon, day before St. Patrick's Day, which, for those of you who are interested, including me, should also be a very sunny day, high of about 46 degrees, so that's a great day for St. Patrick's Day. They said that there would be about a 30% chance of scattered snow showers, this afternoon. I didn't see any. I've been traveling around the county and I haven't seen any. So I'm not sure that anyone had any snow showers this afternoon. But in any event, I think most of us have had a very pleasant day. High today only about 40. So tomorrow should be again about 6 degrees warmer. And then on Sunday, we also should have a sunny day, high of about 42 degrees, and into Monday again, sunny, and I'm not going to go any farther than that because actually it's hard enough to predict a day or two ahead, and I guess they have been correct lately when they've been predicting snow, power outages, winds, but this should be a very nice day. Hopefully everybody is up and the power is up, and we certainly should be able to appreciate the people in Puerto Rico, many of whom are still out and have been out since last September. Any event, I'm Pat Smits, and the program is It's the Law. And of course, let me just play a couple spots from our sponsors, and then we'll be back with some of the latest news, legal news.
Bye. Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Pat Smith. Those of you who know me know I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County. Actually, I practice all over the state, but I certainly enjoy appearing here in court in Hunterdon County. And we're very lucky, for those viewers who live in Hunterdon County, we're very lucky to live here. And I'm certainly glad I don't have to commute into the city every day. Appreciate it for those of you who do. And I think you agree it's still worth living out here. I've had to go into Jersey City a few times lately. And although I really like the judges who are sitting in Jersey City, it's not fun to get into Jersey City from out here, and especially because they're seeming to work on the roads forever. So in any event, what's going on in legal news? Well, one of the things that I think an important case, although this was not approved for publication, and the reason that this case I don't think was approved for publication is that it's so fact-specific. But what it does tell everybody is, you know, if there is a decision and you're working for the state, and in this case, this was an appeals court ruled that the a conviction, a state senator's conviction, warrants forfeiture of his public, his public pension. So the former New Jersey State Senator Wayne Brandt, he was convicted in 2008 on corruption charges, and that was enough to and provided sufficient grounds to withhold his $81,000 state pension. And what's happened with many of these pensions in the past, and one of the criticisms in New Jersey, is there are certain people who are able to double and triple dip into the state pension system. And meanwhile, other people who worked for the state for years, you know, are kind of struggling based on what they're receiving. But in any event, this it's an Employment Benefits Administrative Law case. And it was through the, this was the appellate division, and it was Bryant versus Board of Trustees of the Public Employees Retirement System. And so he had appealed from the agency decision, and this is what happens. These matters go through an administrative judge, and then an agency makes a final decision, depending on the agency. So in this case, the final agency decision decided to forfeit Mr. Brandt's entire PERS service and salary credit, making him ineligible for retirement benefits. So this happened after a plenary hearing before the administrative court, and at that point, and there was testimony, of course, and the administrative law judge considered and balanced the 11 statutory factors and held that forfeiture in that case was warranted. And it found that the misconduct and conviction of Wayne Brandt was directly related to his position as a public official and also demonstrated a high degree of moral turpitude. Now, the administrative law judge said that despite his contributions, Mr. Brandt administratively abused a subordinate for several years. The court affirmed the holding, and it was satisfied that the evidence supported the administrative law judge's decision. and that given the severe criminal nature of the lengthy misconduct, total forfeiture of his pension was warranted, regardless of his many good deeds. And the appellate division found that a lesser punishment would not sufficiently induce people to continue faithful and diligent public employment. And accordingly, the appellate division affirmed. And of course, those of you know me know that I'm a divorce attorney. And of course, what happens in those cases, if somebody, their pension is forfeited, and thereafter they get divorced, there's no pension there to divide. So this, although it's, quite a severe penalty, how else can there be any hope of protecting the state and our citizens when there are such egregious conduct that it takes place by a public official? So now there was a federal lawsuit filed by a man who spent 3 years in prison after a polygraph examiner was allowed to give his opinion on the man's guilt in testimony before a jury. So that is going forward. And the polygraphs are not admissible. And, there's lots of controversy over them and lots of reasons why some people would not pass a polygraph even though they were innocent. There is a showcase presenting the latest campus violence against women, and that was a foundation, and the New Jersey Institute of Continuing Legal Education hosted a violence against women on college campuses update. And the discussion included what colleges and universities have done in the past year to prevent assault and the effect of the current presidential administration, what effect that has had on sexual assault prevention, and also the impact of the Me Too movement in college violence context. This is a severe issue. I remember a few years ago participating in a domestic violence think tank, not quite seminar, but think tank, and there were one of the things that not only were there great discussions, but there was a video of what happened in North Carolina, University of North Carolina, and it was really amazing. Not only did the University of North Carolina, but many other well-known schools, colleges, tried to cover up the actual date rapes, sexual violence, and other predatory behavior on their campuses because, of course, they didn't want parents growing concerned about what might happen to their children on campus. And, of course, there's been a lot of concern about many of the athletic programs, many of the football programs, and protection not only in, well, especially in college, of well-known football players, and some of them have been, the conduct has really been egregious, and they kind of get a bye. So that, that was something that now is really coming, forward, and people are recognizing and trying to deal with it, and I think colleges are becoming more aware of their responsibility. One of the questions that people often ask me, because I do family law, including handling domestic violence cases, is what about legal fees? Because it can be very expensive to go to court. It is very expensive to go to court no matter what it is. But in domestic violence cases, usually the plaintiff goes to the court and files a complaint under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, and then goes before a judge, sometimes a hearing officer, and explains what happened. And almost always a temporary restraining order is issued. Now, once that's served on the spouse or the other, the defendant does not have to be a spouse, pretty loose who can now file and who they can file against. But in any event, what happens is that person is restrained from, could be his or her house or where they live, etc., until there is a final hearing. The final hearing is supposed to take place within 10 days. And the plaintiff, the alleged victim, is permitted to apply for legal fees. Many people would say, unfortunately, the alleged perpetrator is not allowed to apply for legal fees, irrespective of how frivolous the action could be. The reason for that is the stated reason for that, and really the reason for that behind it is the legislature, and proponents of this statute did not want victims to be intimidated. In other words, they did not want victims to feel threatened that if they proceeded with the domestic violence trial and they were not granted a final restraining order, whether or not that would open them up to pay legal fees for the other party. So in any event, the court only will grant legal fees to the victim. And in this case, again, it's initials, which usually is the case when they want to protect the parties' names. And this was not a published opinion, so it can't be used. However, the holding is very helpful because it's N period M period versus A period S period. And in this case, the trial court awarded a minimal counsel fee award. And there had been initially cross complaints under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. However, the defendant withdrew his complaint at the end of the trial. And in fact, the trial judge entered a final restraining order against him and awarded a minimal amount of the fees that the plaintiff had requested. And the trial judge found that the plaintiff's attorney used what we call block billing instead of task billing, and so refused to award fees for time spent on parenting time issues and denied fees on the written summation. So apparently the judge required the attorneys to submit written summations, but then denied the woman's attorney legal fees based on the time he or she had to spend on the written summation. The appellate court, this is an appellate decision, the appellate court agreed that the trial court and with the trial court that the plaintiff could not recover fees exclusively incurred in her defense against the defendant's complaint. Remember, he filed a complaint, which he later withdrew. So she could not get fees based on that because in that part of it, he was at least the alleged victim. But the appellate court disagreed with the trial judge's method to deal with the overlap in fees. So in this case, obviously, both people had filed complaints under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, so it posed somewhat of a problem because the judge could only award fees to the victim and couldn't award fees to the victim for when she was defending against the other complainant. Let's assume it's a husband, but we don't know. And so that was one issue. And however, as I said, they disagreed with the way that the trial judge dealt with the overlap in fees. And the appellate division, and this is important for attorneys and for plaintiffs who need to go forward to protect themselves. In this case, the judge, according to the appellate division, should have decided which services were rendered regardless of the defendant's cross-complaint and award fees for those services. And then the court also found no legal basis to exclude fees related to custody and parenting time orders, especially since the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act expressly provided for the entry of parenting time orders. So additionally, and what is important for those of us who do block billing, is that fees incurred on a written summation were, well, that was in other words, the attorney was entitled to be compensated for that time. But the appellate division, and this is what is important, even though this is not a published opinion, the trial court also erred in rejecting the block billed time and should have determined whether the hours reasonably correlated to the activities performed. In other words, many attorneys, and I'm one of them, I use a computer program, so if I'm whatever my first thing is that I do, I put down that in the file for that day for the client. And let's say I write a letter and it takes me 15 minutes, that goes in a 0.25. Then if I send the client an email, my next entry would be email to client, and that would go in perhaps a 0.1, maybe 0.2, depending on how long it was. So the block billing automatically adds up everything that's done for that day. But you wouldn't be able to tell how much I actually billed for the email unless after every entry I put the amount of time. And I think what the court is saying here is it's okay to use a method that I use and adding up everything automatically. And then at the end of the day, it depends on how much time is on, but that would be the billing for that day. So I think most of us are very happy to see this decision. And talking about decision, the decision now is to have you hear from some of the sponsors of the programs.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para-planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Hi, we're back. It's the law. I'm talking about some of the legal news, including the cases that have been recently decided. And I will tell you if they're not published. Usually I try to limit my comments to published cases, although I think some of the unpublished cases are certainly more interesting and provide a lot more information. So there's a case, an insurance law case, State Farm Insurance Company versus Hereford Insurance Company. And in this case, the defendant appealed from an order denying its motion to compel the Selected Arbitration Organization, Arbitration Forms, Inc., to hold in-person hearings. And the defendant's motion arose from an underlying automobile accident and subsequent dispute between the defendant and plaintiff regarding reimbursement of PIP benefits. So plaintiff paid such benefits to his insured and sought reimbursement from defendant insurance company, and they were the insurance company of the tortfeasor. Now plaintiff moved to compel arbitration and with AF, with whom plaintiff had a contract to arbitrate PIP reimbursement disputes. And defendant was not a party to that contract. And plaintiff's contract with AF did not require AF to hold arbitration hearings in person. So that's the issue here, whether or not the arbitration hearing has to be held in person. And the trial court granted plaintiff's motion to compel arbitration with AF, noting that the defendant had failed to suggest an alternative arbitration form or provide reasons why AF should not conduct the arbitration. So although AF was conducting in-person hearings at the time of the trial's, at the time of the trial court order, it subsequently ceased in-person hearings in favor of telephonic conferences. Well, I certainly understand why someone would object to telephonic conferences. I found one time I was involved in a pension, it was actually an appeal, and no one had asked for oral argument. So in the appellate division, at least I've never seen them deny oral argument, but you have to ask for it. And then for some reason, they did allow oral argument, but only by telephone. And I found it very troublesome. You just could not argue effectively by the telephone because you couldn't see any of the judges' reactions. I mean, a lot of what we do on appellate work, especially in oral argument, is we're responding to the judges. And I found it was easy for everyone to cut each other off on the telephone. And to me, it was just not worth it. I mean, if you have to do telephone decisions and conferences are okay. And however the judges make their decisions, but the point is you do need oral argument in person. You need testimony in person to really be effective. So in any event, in this case, it subsequently, AF subsequently stopped having in-person hearings in favor of telephonic conferences. So then the defendant filed the present motion to compel an in-person hearing and arguing simply that the Arbitration Act required an in-person hearing for all arbitrations. And the trial court denied the defendant's motion, ruling that in-person hearings were not required by the Act and that the parties would not be deprived of due process if a hearing, telephonic hearing, went forward. So on appeal, the defendant reiterated its argument that the Act required arbitrary They have arbitrarial down, so that's why. Arbitrary forms to conduct in-person hearings. So the court rejected the defendant's argument and affirmed the trial court. The court noted that the Act did not require arbitrator to hold a hearing, but where a hearing was held, the parties have the right to notice, to be heard, to be pressed, and to be present at a hearing, and also to present material evidence and to cross-examine the witnesses in the other case. So thus, in this case, the court held that in the absence of a contractual requirement, AF was not obligated to conduct an in-person hearing. So that now can proceed without an in-person hearing. Again, I certainly would take an opposite view because I just don't think they're effective. Sometimes it's the guy who speaks the best, or, you know, the first one out, or the person, last person to get, strike that. So what else is happening in, you know, the, this one is interesting from a standpoint if you're a job switcher. There are divergent appellate rulings with respect to unemployment for job switchers. And so now the New Jersey Supreme Court is going to examine this issue. This was a state appeal by the state in the case of a worker who was granted unemployment benefits after she left one job for a better paying job, only to find later that the second job disappeared into full air. So that was the situation. She left one job for a better paying job, obviously didn't realize the possible consequences of that. There is a working group that's come up with nearly 20 reforms aimed at dealing with concerns about the workplace harassment throughout the federal judicial system. I think many people might think that some places have need for this now. Now, there is a case, I don't think I talked about it last week. It was a criminal law case, and however, it has family implications. Because in that case, the state appealed from the appellate division's ruling granting the defendant leave to withdraw her family, withdraw her guilty plea, vacating her conviction, and having the division's rule, meaning DCPMP, requiring them to go to trial, requiring everybody to go to trial. She wanted to have her case listed for trial. And she was arrested on two outstanding bench warrants while in the interrogation room, she placed her purse on the table in front of her. And detectives began to question her about her relationship with a certain man. And they asked her about this relationship with him. He had actually been stabbed 2 days prior. So what happened? Well, during the interrogation process, the detectives restrained the defendant, informing her that she had an outstanding warrant. Then the detectives took the defendant's purse, and defendant declined their offer to inventory her purse. So the she didn't allow them to take and go through her purse, they took her purse, and she declined the offer to inventory her purse herself. And the detectives began employing self-help, i.e. they were emptying the contents of her person. So although in this case the trial court granted the defendant's motion to suppress her statements to the police for lack of a Miranda warning, it denied her motion to suppress physical evidence found in her purse. Specifically, they found an EBT card belonging to another individual, not to the person who owned the purse. And then the trial court ruled that the defendants had to be found before the card plan, while it was still conducting a valid inventory search. They don't want the things. So, as I said, the appellate division reversed the trial court ruling that the physical evidence from defendant's purse should have been suppressed because the detective's inventory search turned into a warrantless investigatory search and not what they were trying to say. And on appeal, the court affirmed the court noted the defendant was not arrested before her purse was impounded and no safety justification existed as it was not searched when the defendant was brought to the interrogation room. In any event, the court found that the inventory search would have been limited to the cash defendant expressed concern for. So, like it or not, that's a decision in that particular case. And we'll be back after we play a few more spots from our sponsors. And a news break.
USA Radio News.
Today, during the White House press briefing, Sarah Sanders said there would be no immediate personnel changes. She also expanded on all this talk of changes coming in the White House.
Our focus is not on a lot of the news stories that you guys would like us to be focused on, but we're actually focused on what the American people want us to do, and that's to come here and do our jobs. General McMaster is a dedicated public servant, and he is here not focused on the news stories that many of you are writing, but on some really big issues.
At least six people are confirmed dead after a 950-ton pedestrian bridge at Florida International University collapsed in Miami-Dade County yesterday. Miami-Dade Police Chief Juan Perez spoke earlier today at a press conference.
Right now, we just want to find out what occurred, what caused this collapse to occur, and people to die.
This is USA Radio News.
We are snackers, just like 91% of Americans are snackers.
Oh, please. I think that's a low estimate, frankly.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's really funny is that years ago we were all kind of avoiding snacking, or if we were snacking, we were hiding and, you know, hiding our paper.
Closet snackers, yeah.
When we think of snack foods, we think of chips and, you know, nuts and sort of the classic stuff. But there is so much innovation in the frozen food aisle as far as snacks. So March, I don't know if you guys know, is frozen food month. And I have, like, you know, as far as the frozen food snacks, I have three categories. I've got my healthy, I've got my sweet, which is fabulous, and my savory. And with March Madness upon us, it's a very busy month.
Yes.
Between shopping for frozen foods, getting all your specials, and then watching basketball,
yeah.
You know. So my savory, those are sort of my savory game day snacks. So healthy is as easy as the edamame, which I adore. Go to easyhomemeals.com. You can enter where they're having a contest, food steak, where you can win $5,000.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Well, good afternoon. I'm back. The weather today, tomorrow, and Sunday is going to be sunny and in the 40s, so it should be a nice time to at least get outside and after probably clean up some of the debris left from the all of the snow and storms and wind. And I mean, there are some huge trees that went over, unfortunately, some beautiful trees. And I know that including one, you know, on our road that created some minor problems, put it that way. You know, one of the questions now are in divorce cases is if it is a mandatory retirement age for a field of work, then what is significant in showing a good faith retirement under the statutes and other under the statute, there's a specific statute now, NJSA 2A colon 34-23, paren JN paren paren 2 and paren paren B and paren C and paren. Lots of parens here. But the point is, everyone needs to really look at this statute when they're planning, actually when they're planning a divorce, especially if you're older, because the factors in that subsection are really important. And one of the real issues, of course, is whether or not the retirement, if it's younger than mandatory retirement, not mandatory, excuse me, full retirement age under Social Security, whether or not that is, you know, what's the, what should that person be working? In other words, there are certain jobs where you can retire after a certain number of years. Let's say it's 30 years. But if you start that job when you're 22 years old, you know, you're going to be 52 years old when you retire. And, you know, the certain jobs, for example, one of the questions comes up. This man was retired at 57 years old from the prison system due to mandatory retirement by the organization. He was receiving a pension. Now his former wife was getting the marital share of his pension. And yet he was still able to work in some capacity. He's not going to be earning the same amount of money. And the question is, will he be able to modify or terminate alimony based upon the mandatory retirement and decreased earnings? And so the question here is, these are things that people should attempt to negotiate at the time of the divorce, because otherwise people are going to have to go back to court and spend a lot of money. Another question that's come up recently is, what about a child or a parent who's receiving SSI? And in that case, there are case law on that, that the obligor, the person paying child support, is not entitled to a downward adjustment for the child's the receipt that the child receives of SSI. And so these questions are, they're specific cases, and that's what the trial judges have to follow, as long as they're, you know, appellate cases and not another trial judge's decision. So a number of people have asked me, you know, what were the really important cases in 2017 with respect to family law? Now, I don't always talk about family law, but I think there are some important cases. And, of course, the other thing that happened in 2017 is Judge Marie Lighthouse retired from the appellate division. There have only been a few other jurists, like Justice Virginia Long, who've had a greater impact on the development of the case law for our family law practice. In 2017, before she retired, Judge Lighthouse authored three opinions, which, you know, we always talk about what are the top 10, but at least this is in one of the top 10 that was included in a recent symposium. And of course, there's just been, there have been so many that she's authored, so many unpublished, of course, but so many published cases that are really important cases and that we will continue to use for many, you know, many, many years. And so she will be missed, truly missed. And like a lot of other judges, she's going to be doing some mediation and acting as a discovery master and an arbitrator and a mediator. So there were not as many published opinions in 2017, but there were some very important ones, and probably I think most family lawyers would agree that the most important decision that came from the Supreme Court was Bisbing versus Bisbing, because that absolutely changed the standard for child relocation. What do I mean by that? Well, in New Jersey, if children have been born and lived here for 5 years, or even if they weren't born here, if they've lived here for 5 years, a parent in a divorce situation cannot just up and move the child out of the state without permission of the other parent or a court order. And these are called relocation cases, because one parent wants to relocate out of the state of New Jersey, and the other parent doesn't want to lose contact with the children. And so these are the toughest cases. They really are. They're heartbreaking, because you know that if a child is moving out of state, the left-behind parent, in probably 99.9% of the cases, cannot maintain the same relationship. I suppose if someone is a pilot and, you know, their home base is Kennedy, but flies back and forth from here to California, the fact that the child moves to California wouldn't have as much of an impact, because the pilot parent could arrange a flight schedule that would allow him or her to see the child really regularly. But in most cases, it has a tremendous impact and a real significant impact on children. So in a nutshell, I think most attorneys in New Jersey, if you scratch the surface, would have admitted and acknowledged that the standard in New Jersey was too easy. In other words, very often it was a custodial parent, the parent who had primary custody. So that could be, instead of 7 out of 14 days, the other parent could have 6 out of 14. Still meant that there was a primary parent of primary residence is what we talk about in New Jersey. And frankly, it was pretty easy for that person to move. They had to have a good faith reason. And then the other thing is they had to have a good faith reason and show that it was not inimical to the child, another harmful to the child. And the standard, as I said, was very easy. And this has gone on since the 2001 case called Bowers versus Lewis. And so this Bowers versus Lewis was another Supreme Court case. So it's highly unusual for the Supreme Court to completely change course. But that's what they did. In the Bisbing case that was decided in, I'll never forget, well, I may forget someday, but it was decided on August 8th of 2017. And that changed the standard, and the focus was not on the best interest of the parent who wanted to relocate, But the focus now is on what is in the child's best interest. And, for example, I was literally in the middle of a relocation case when the Supreme Court decision came down. So the entire focus of the trial had to change. I thought that the case should be dismissed and then be brought up again under the new standard. The judge did not agree with me. So we continued to try the case based on the new standard. We were entitled to call new witnesses, recall our clients. But it was a very, very difficult, to say the very least. It was not easy. But I think that most attorneys would agree that that is, in fact, the better standard. But it also means it's going to be much more difficult for a parent to move out of state if the other parent has been involved with the child or children. So that was Bisbing versus Bisbing. And then the question, there was another interesting case, and parents should be interested in this one, because it's Ricky versus Ricky. And the question was, does a 23-year-old child have standing to intervene as a third party in a dissolution action where the parents seek to emancipate the child and terminate child support? So that was a procedural question, and this was answered in the affirmative, and that the appellate division said yes, where it can be shown that a child has an interest in the subject matter of the litigation and has an inability to protect that interest, they have standing to intervene. So that was one of the issues. And then, of course, there was another issue in that case, whether the family court can conduct a hearing to determine the extent of a parent's college contribution for their child without first reviewing the facts in order to determine whether a child is emancipated. And, of course, the answer in that was no, because emancipation is a legal determination which must be resolved prior to awarding support, including any payment of college costs that have to be made by parents. Because if the child is emancipated, then obviously the parents have no obligation to support that child. And New Jersey is one of the few states that do require parents to contribute towards college education. I'm not saying in every case, but in many cases. So the next case was federal court case, and the question is, the issue was, may a state court like New Jersey order a veteran to indemnify their spouse in a divorce action where the veteran does not declare their waiver of the military retirement pay for disability benefits under the Uniform Service Former Spouses Protection Act and until after the divorce is finalized. No, in this case, the federal courts relied on a case, Mansell versus Mansell, and the Supreme Court declared that federal law preempts states from treating waived military retirement pay as vested property, which is subject to division in a divorce. So this is fairly significant in a case where somebody is going to both has a military pension and then a portion of it, which is a disability pension. And in this particular case, for example, the husband elected to partially waive his military retirement pay, which compelled him to forego approximately $250 because he instead was getting a partial disability due to a service-related injury. So that he had to forego about $250 of his $1,500 monthly pension benefits that he previously shared with his wife. And he did that in order to become eligible and begin receiving disability. So as a result, the waiver, his waiver, reduced the wife's portion of his pension by $125 a month. And so that, and this was not a New Jersey case. However, it was an important case, and the has impact everywhere. Because, as I said, federal law does take precedence, and states cannot rule contrary to the federal statutes or cases when they're applicable. So basically what we say is that federal law preempts the states when they're dealing with federal issues, and of course military retirement, military disability is handled on the federal level. So that's going to be about it for today, and hope you're interested in some of these cases. And what all of this shows or should show is, before, if you have any questions, if you have legal questions, contact an attorney. You know, have an initial consultation, because one of the things that I find and continue to find is so often people do foolish things without realizing it, and if they had simply contacted an attorney, they would understand that you know, what their rights are, what they perhaps should have considered before doing what I consider the foolish thing. And we're not, or should not be, scary out there. So until next week, back with the law, and we'll be following up with the sports guys after the break.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors...
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has came out and said he would oppose President Trump's nominations for Secretary of State and CIA Director. Today at the White House press briefing, Sarah Sanders said the White House would be making sure that all these senators have the proper information on nominees.
We specifically want to make sure that people actually have an accurate reflection, which I know some of the senators, including Rand Paul, made comments off of incorrect information.